This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. The Premier League is heating up, so let's just stick a World Cup in there and get back to this on Boxing Day. Have any Arsenal fans said mind the gap yet? A 5-point lead at the top after Brentford shocked Pep at the Etihad. Perhaps the greatest result in their history, definitely deserved, as Ivan Toney, capital letters, sends a message to Gareth Southgate. Antonio Conte finally decides to go full Ardiles, or are they a bit lucky as Rodrigo Bentancur drags them to victory over Leeds? Are we taking Arsenal so seriously we don't have time to take Newcastle seriously? A fifth straight win over out-of-sorts Chelsea, for whom this break, capital letters again, can't come soon enough. Garnacho wins it late for Man United at Fulham. Darwin Nunes is good again. Leicester are good again. And whose crisis is bigger, Moyes or Lampard? We'll be utterly outraged by the England squad. Discuss Joe Lycett's challenge to Qatar ambassador David Beckham. Find out where David Platt is. Answer your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jonathan Wilson, welcome.
Evening, how you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. Hello, Troy Townsend.
Ah, good evening.
Good evening, and hello, John Bruin.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very good, thanks. Let's start the Etihad. Manchester City 1, Brentford 2. Thomas Frank says, probably the biggest result in the club's history. I mean, we all remember the 8-0 win over Brighton in the Football League South War Cup on the 4th of March 1944. I mean, Wilson probably does remember that. Do you think, Wilson, the biggest result in your history can be in the middle of a season? It feels like it is statistically their best win ever, but it also can't be because it doesn't mean anything apart from 3 points.
Well, I guess you then get into the question of what's the point of the teams who aren't the big six, seven, whatever that now is. You might argue that for Brentford it was getting promoted. I confess I can't remember exactly the seconds in which they confirmed promotion.
It was a playoff win, wasn't it?
I don't know. So, yeah, it's been the most eye-catching win since they returned to the Premier League. I don't know whether 75 years ago they had any particularly eye-catching wins, but even I'd be reluctant to quibble with Thomas Frank. I'd just be reluctant to quibble with him. He seems a very energetic man who'd soon overwhelm me with his energy. But he'd be better at
quibbling.
Absolutely.
And you're quite good at it.
Well, no, I would actually be better at quibbling, but it's more the counter quibble. That's where I think I'd.
I'm certainly not going to quibble with you about this discussion. The thing is, Troy, this wasn't smash and grab, was it? They absolutely deserved this win.
It was a magnificent performance, wasn't it? They set up well. They denied City space in and around the box. You know, they were often defending with 10 men in their box, and obviously their keeper. But it was the counter-attack that was so exciting for me, the way that they drove forward and caused City no ends of problems in that way. And obviously that's the way that they got the winner, potentially should have got another two after that. One cleared off the line from Kevin De Bruyne. It was just a really good performance, a really, really top-class performance from a Brentford side that hadn't won away from home so far in the Prem, and City, who were looking to break all kind of records at home for the day. So, yeah, I was surprised that Diaz didn't play, because I felt that a Diaz up against an Ivan Toney, it's a different kind of game, you know. That was Brentford's ploy, was to go long to Toney and then bring everyone into play. And I was really surprised for this one that Diaz didn't play. I know he's not been playing many games lately, but, you know, up against the other two centre-halves, you're always going to bet for Ivan Toney to do that. And what a great game he had.
Yeah, Bill says, is Ivan Toney chartering his own plane? It's interesting, John. Gary Lineker on Match of the Day asked if Ivan Toney had done that last week, would it have made a difference?
I don't think it would, no, because Gareth Southgate, I mean, he says he picks on form, but he picks players that he likes, but he sticks with those. I mean, obviously, Harry Maguire's presence in the squad is testament to that. But remember, Ivan Toney was called up to the England squad, and it didn't feel like there was a great, it didn't really happen for him during that session of England matches. I think Ivan Toney, it's one of those things, isn't it? England always looking for something different, the wild card. And Ivan Toney could have been that player, but he isn't going to be that player. And Callum Wilson, you can't say he doesn't deserve to be there. I suppose the only question I would have over for Callum Wilson over Ivan Toney is that I probably trust Ivan Toney's fitness a bit more. Now, whether that matters within a short tournament like that, or the, actually it may matter even more because of that time period. But actually, you asked Jonathan about the Thomas Frank. Thomas Frank, I do think, is a great salesman for Brentford. He's done a great job. He's a pretty good salesman for himself as well, isn't he? And actually, if you looked over, he was linked with the Aston Villa job not too long ago, but he could, you know, he's one of these that I imagine Thomas Frank has a pretty up to date CV. Yeah, in a ring binder or something like that.
Think he's ready to go at any time.
He's ready to go. Push the PowerPoint, off we go. Now, I'm not saying he wants to leave Brentford. Don't get excited or anything like that. But I think if he's an ambitious guy, and he deserves to be an ambitious guy, he's a good manager. But this season, you've got that match against Manchester United, which I went to that game, and he said, you know, this is one of the greatest matches results in our history. And then he goes to City, and that is a better result, it has to be said. And he was correct in saying that, you know, they're probably the best team in the world, and we've pulled off this result, we're little Brentford. So, well done, Thomas Frank, but there's a guy with his eye on what's next. Fair enough.
Yeah. Do managers need CVs? I mean, not, what is it? No, do they have... Usually everyone knows sort of where they've been. I think their A-level results. What, does Abitur, yeah. Thomas Frank's Abitur that he's done, and his interest in fell walking.
Steve McLaren's full clean driving license. Yeah, I mean, it's... there was that idea, wasn't there, that back in the... I think when Steve McLaren, actually, the reason I mentioned his name is when he got a couple of jobs, and I'm thinking of the Middlesbrough one and also maybe the England job, that Steve McLaren gave the best presentation.
Well, the problem for Thomas Frank is, I don't know if, I presume he was educated in Denmark, but the Danish marking system is one of the most bonkers things in the world. Are you aware of this?
I'm not aware of the Danish marking system, I'm not.
So, the equivalent of an A is a 12, the equivalent of a B is a 10, right. The equivalent of a C is a 7, the equivalent of a D is a 4, the equivalent of an E is a 0-2.
Right. But I think they do that in England now. I mean, I know we're all old.
Yeah, but
you don't get A's in A level.
Yeah, but it's not a contiguous scale. It goes 12, 10, 7, 4, 0, 2, 0, 0, minus 3.
Wow. Okay.
And I think the reason for that is that when you apply for university or something, you have to achieve a certain total score. So, yeah, you need to get, I don't know, 35. So if you get 3 12s but also minus 3, you don't get in.
Oh, I see.
I think that's how it
is. I just knocked further maths off my CV because I got a D and I just didn't want anyone to know about it. We should probably talk about the football a bit more than the Danish marking system, Troy. Is that a blueprint then for how to beat City? To knock it long in a kind of... It wasn't just total agriculture, was it? They knew what they were doing. They had people around Ivan Toney. They fed off that and then they played good football off the back of it.
Yeah, but it wasn't only that, Matt. And we can't say whether that's a blueprint because I think teams have beaten Man City before and other teams have tried to mimic the way that they have and it just hasn't worked. So it depends on your personnel. But it also depends on those players being switched on for the whole game. And also, you know, in a defensive manner, like I said, they just crowded every time the ball was whipped in for a cross. They made sure that I don't think they were particularly marking. They were just crowding the box and making sure that City players couldn't get shots off. The only one that did and did with aplomb was obviously Foden, but Haaland was marked as well as I've seen him, you know, throughout the time that he's had it over here when he's been breaking all kind of records. And if one didn't get him, the other one got him, or he was slipping over. I don't know what boots he was wearing, but he was slipping over. So you've got to credit the whole setup because if one chink of that armory doesn't work, then they don't get that result. And they even made changes and the players who came on, you know, did exactly the same job. It was an outstanding performance from Brentford. I don't even want to talk about City's weaknesses at the time because Brentford exposed them and did so well to get the result.
It's easy to say, okay, sit deep. You put a man either side of Haaland, hit them on the break. The quality of those two breaks, I mean, there was clearly the plan to go long to Toney, and then the way they always got four men around him showed a level of organisation. It wasn't simply going along. But the quality of those two breaks in injury time, the one they scored from, then the one whereas Clemens off the line, was exceptional. And both of those, I mean, Tony clearly, but also the two substitutes, Wissa and Josh De Silva. And the, particularly the goal, the way that Wissa makes up, you know, he just charges, what, 80 yards? I mean, I guess he couldn't have done that had he been on from the start. I think he came on 74 minutes, something like that. There's not many teams, A, have that level of organisation to break as effectively as that. And I think the fact that those two breaks are quite similar in shape suggests it was a plan. But also the teams don't have the depth of squad to have two players who can do that coming off the bench.
And Rico Henry, I thought, was absolutely brilliant in this game. And I imagine...
Performing a similar role before he went off, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, if he doesn't have a CV, he could get one. And then people would sniff around and like to have a look at that CV. Let's go to the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. Spurs 4, Leeds 3, just because it was a brilliant game. I don't really know how you analyse a game of football like this, Troy, apart from Tottenham. Did Tottenham get away with it? Did they deserve it? I can't really tell.
This was the game I focused on Saturday afternoon, and I'm really pleased I did, because it was, it's back to a throwback. You say our dealers at the beginning, it was a throwback to his teams. It was a throwback to Bielsa's Leeds when they first came into the Premier League. I don't know how Spurs won. I honestly don't know how Spurs won. My brother-in-law went to the game. Sorry, my son-in-law. My brother-in-law's a lot older. And left at 3-2. Okay, left at 3-2. Yeah, excellent. Absolutely. He always does. When Spurs are losing, he thinks there's not long to go. I'm bolting out the door. Defensively, this game was horrendous. So anyone that's a defensive coach needs to look away now. Eric Dier called up for the England squad. I thought had a really, really bad game, and I thought Dyer's had a half-decent season, but Spurs' defence looked all over the place. There was a couple of question marks against Hugo Lloris as well and his positioning, but then you could say the same for Leeds. You know, Kulusevski was outstanding, but was helped quite a lot by some very, very poor defending. But it was a game that kept you on your toes. Spurs were being booed off at half time. Emerson was booed after a shot when I think it went clean out of the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. And it looked like just one of those where, you know, Leeds were going to win. All the pressure was going to be on Conte again. But there's something about this Spurs side, even in adversity, where at times they managed to pull something around. And Benton Kerr, who would have matched Kulusevski for man of the match, came up with two great strikes, which again, one of them I'm going to question the goalkeeping on, but it gave them a win. And lo and behold, still provides a little bit of optimism for Spurs, even though they got knocked out of obviously the Carabao Cup at the week midweek, because they're up there, they're in fourth. You could still say they're challenging. They're through to the Champions League. I would question defensively what is going on, and I think Conte can't wait for January. But they're winning games that maybe they shouldn't. I'm not sure if that's the best summary, but it's the one that I saw anyway.
Yeah, no, that sounds about right. Bentancur Wilson is an interesting player. After the game, Kulusevski said he's one of the most underrated players in the world. It's nice to have another. We haven't had a really underrated player for a while. Can we put Bentancur in that list?
I think you probably could have done about a month ago. I think he's been very obviously brilliant for about a month. And he started scoring goals as well. And you know, he got the winner at Bournemouth as well, didn't he? But yeah, he's such a complete player that he's, you know, he's ostensibly a holding midfielder, but he also does arrive late in the box. He's very good at picking up the pieces outside the box. And I think that's where Leeds, from a defensive point of view, like the fourth goal, I know was just horrible. But I think to an extent it's explicable just by exhaustion. And yeah, they highlighted on Match of the Day that Liam Cooper not getting back, but he just looked absolutely shattered. And you know, Liam Cooper's not that young. And it was the 87th minute. So I sort of understand why he'd be shattered playing that style of football. But it's the second and third goals, I think the defending is just awful. That both of them, they end up with six outfield players in the box and a man unmarked on the edge of the box. And that's, you know, you've got the players back, but just the disposition of them is totally wrong. And that seems to be something pretty basic that shouldn't be happening.
John, Kulusevski's an interesting player, isn't he? Because he can beat people despite... sort of looking at him neither being quick or like devastatingly skillful, just by sort of moving. He just sort of moves past people.
He's quite big as well, isn't he? So But we have had skillful big players before. Let's wander down that cliche lane, you know, Zinedine Zidane being one, and he's perhaps not on that level, but he's a very skillful player, and he's also something of a talisman to Tottenham, isn't he? They missed him terribly when he wasn't around. Conte is doing a job there. I just don't think either he's happy or a lot of the Spurs fans are happy. The one thing I say, and this refers back to both Leeds and Tottenham, if you're a manager, okay, so Jesse Marsh, you know, wins a game 4-3 and then loses a game 4-3. If your matches are that out of control, are you doing a good job? That's the question I would ask of him. And I would also suggest that a lot of the games that Tottenham have been involved in recently, say the Sporting Lisbon game, for example, the games have been, have got out of control of what Conte is, a manager that likes to, you know, grasp hold of the game and strangle it. But somehow we are at a point where Tottenham go into the winter break in fourth, and I'm not really sure how, and I'm not even sure anyone knows.
No, we should. Leeds fans will be annoyed if we don't mention Kane's goal. It does look like Longley's foul, yes, smelly, yes, there, don't you think, Wilson?
Yeah, completely.
John Bruin's confirmed.
Yeah, no, I agree.
We all,
yeah,
think that. Although Kane did very well, didn't he? Get him on that plane. Lovely first touch. Lovely goal. Boom.
Big man.
Jim, absolutely skillful big man. Yeah. Jim says, given that Song Heung-min looked like a trendy college professor at the weekend, what subject do you reckon his teach? He had an absolutely tremendous cardigan on, didn't he? And actually, with his cardigan and his little glasses, he looked so unlike a devastatingly brilliant footballer. It was almost like a sort of superhero movie where he'd never get picked. He'd be in that cardigan and glasses, and then eventually someone would say, oh, just pick that guy, I bet he's okay. And then they realise it's one of the greatest footballers on earth. Maybe that's overstating it.
He looked like one of these crypto kids that are currently on the run from the FBI. Yes. Yeah, that's.
We do plan actually to do another crypto special, but hopefully one that we understand this time. after the World Cup. Newcastle 1, Chelsea 0. Bob says, at what point will the likes of Chelsea, Arsenal, Manchester United and Man City start looking to Cambridge United to learn how to win a game at St James's Park? That's how you know you're going to get a question asked on this pod. Is that Wilson, a statement win, another one? Or is a win against Chelsea a statement win at the moment? What was this?
I don't think Newcastle have actually had a statement win this season. Yeah, they often win at Tottenham. I think this is Chelsea side, but there for the beating. But the point is, Newcastle are winning these games, and they are third in the table. And given that I think there's understandable scepticism as to whether Arsenal can keep it going, they're only 2 points behind Manchester City. I admittedly haven't played a game more, but if you're only 2 points behind the favourites for the title, you're definitely in the title race, aren't you? And I suspect their ambitions at the start of the season were to qualify for the Europa League, get in the top six. But I think when they come back after Christmas, it should be top four. And who knows, if City have a post-World Cup wobble, and nobody quite knows how players are going to react to the World Cup, why wouldn't they be in it? I mean, yeah, they're clearly not favourites for a title race. They're clearly outsiders in it. But I think they are in it.
I wonder, John, if there's a bit like with Leicester when they won the league, that and it's perhaps too early to say this about Newcastle, and then I don't think they'll win the league, but, you know, who knows, that you still go and go, look, Joe Willock, Longstaff, Joe Linton, they're not that good. We'll probably beat them. And actually, that's part of that sort of underestimating Leicester was a huge part, I think, of why they won that title. And I don't know if there's a sort of similar feeling with looking at Newcastle now. You look at the team on paper and go, it's got some great players, but some kind of okay players.
When Leicester won the league, I think it's fair to say, for all the romance of that, that the rest of the Premier League was not at its best. All the other contenders. And there is a case that beyond Manchester City and, say, Arsenal blow up, then Newcastle could pull off what we have to, you know, do a Leicester. How well are they set up for after the World Cup? Well, quite a few of the players you mentioned aren't going to the World Cup. You know, Sven Botman is their star central defender. He isn't going. Okay, they'll be concerned Bruno Guimaraes might play a bit. Callum Wilson, you know, is a reserve. I suppose one of the things is that Eddie Howe, you know, they've got all this momentum. And then, of course, there is 6 weeks when they're not away. But, I mean, one of the things about at Newcastle at the moment is, and this probably won't be a popular comparison, but you compare them to Manchester City in their early days of switching over from being, you know, the previous Manchester City to the cash-rich one. Players like Joe Willock, who obviously scored the goal last night, Miguel Almiron, remind me of players like Stephen Ireland was one of the star players for Manchester City, wasn't he? And then I worry for them because those are good players and they've done a great job for the club. And you wonder at what point the club stops being sentimental about them and moves them on, because obviously the trajectory is moving forward. And even someone like Eddie Howe is doing such a great job that what's his ceiling? And we don't know any of these factors. But when it comes to this season, Newcastle are in a great position. We're only 14, 15 matches in. Long way to go, but they're well set up. They're in absolute dreamland. The fans are really enjoying themselves. I hope you're enjoying yourselves. Perhaps not everybody else is enjoying it, but that's sort of the point of Newcastle these days, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, on that subject, a group of Newcastle fans staged a silent protest against the club's Saudi owners ahead of the game. Members of Newcastle United Football Club fans against sports washing gathered outside St James's Park. It wasn't a huge protest, but, you know, credit to them for doing it. And what they said, actually, is that a lot of the criticism and abuse that they've had on social media hasn't come from real Newcastle fans. And the reception they got from Newcastle fans, whether they agreed or disagreed with the protest, was, you know, they are, you know, they valued their right to peacefully protest about this thing. So that is, it's an interesting sign. And, you know, given that it's not easy to protest against your football team when they are playing so well and winning, you know, given the reaction that you will get. So good for them. Three defeats in a row for Chelsea, Wilson. Is Graham Potter in crisis? Are Chelsea in crisis? What's happening?
But yeah. I think as well that the games before that, when with hindsight, you sort of realise Kepa maybe papered over the cracks a bit. And then, you know, the game away at Villa, for instance, they played pretty poorly and got away with it. The game at Palace, they needed that brilliant last-minute goal from Conor Gallagher. So I think there was a sort of sense of Potter sort of slowly knitting things together. And actually, maybe it was the opposite. Maybe kind of getting results that performance didn't quite deserve. But I think you look at the squad, it's pretty unbalanced. I think the injury to East James has really hammered them, exposed weaknesses there. Yeah, they have had a lot of defensive injuries with Fofana being out and Koulibaly and Chilwell now as well. And I think that would hit any squad. But I think also, they just look at a squad that doesn't fit together. And you come back to this basic point that we've been saying all season, that they invested a lot of money over the summer, what, 150 million quid over the summer? Or more than
something
that.
Like that. A lot of money.
A huge amount of money, maybe even 200 million over the summer. And then sacked the bloke who'd done the job. And, you know, immediately, as soon as the window was over. And this wasn't that they sacked the manager, but actually the sporting director had been doing it. There wasn't the sporting director. So Tuchel was as involved in recruitment as any manager at a top six club is these days. And yet still they get rid of him. So if you're Raheem Sterling, and Sterling sort of raised this, I thought, pretty mildly, pretty politely, just sort of as, it wasn't sort of a rant, it wasn't an attack at anybody, just sort of said, well, I don't really know what I'm doing because this isn't the manager who signed me and I don't particularly want to play at wing back. I'll do it, but I want to play as a forward. That's why I came here. And you sort of think all those players arrived in the summer must be going through a similar process of thinking, well, this isn't what I signed up to. What does this new bloke want? That's not necessarily casting aspersions on Potter or what his ceiling may be. It's just saying, he's not the bloke who signed me and I don't really know what's going on. So I'm not surprised there's sort of confusion there. And there were structural problems there even before Abramovich left, that they shouldn't be that reliant on Thiago Silva. You can't, and brilliant as he's been in the last 2 years, you can't be that reliant on somebody who's now 38. Lukaku not working out means there's a hole in centre forward, and Aubameyang's come in, but he's obviously a short-term fix. The back of midfield needs sorting out because Jorginho and Kante both alongside the 30, both out of contract in the summer, and neither of them have signed a new contract, so there's doubts there. If Kante's not fit, we don't have a ball winner. You don't have a ball winner, it exposes back three, and that's very exposable when Thiago Silva's there and has no pace. So there's all kinds of problems in that squad that I don't think are particularly to do with Potter, but he I suspect will take the blame for it.
Graham Potter, like a few managers we've mentioned and are going to mention, he's going to have to give good training camp, isn't he? Like, this is going to be the, you know, the those of us still on the Premier League beat up, there's going to be a lot of talk about training camps, what went on in the training camp. And there's some sort of training camp long reads. I'm looking forward to the training camp long reads.
There's only going to be like four Chelsea players there, aren't they? I mean, you know, how much work can he do with, I can't think of one.
Aubameyang is there.
With Jorginho, I guess, you know, that's it. It's just, yeah, Jorginho and Aubameyang. Keep passing it to him and that's it. And the rest of them have just come back from World Cup. So Chilwell and James, I guess, just sort of in the rehab centre. Anyway.
Fafana, yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Anyway, that'll do for part one. Part two will begin at Molineux. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Thursday night. Still a handful of tickets left for the live show at Earth in Hackney. Come along, please, at theguardian.com/guardianlive, streamed around the world. And so you can all come and watch us and it'll be good. And there are some special guests and we'll have a nice time. Wolves 0, Arsenal 2. We've mentioned Arsenal a bit, but this, Troy, felt like a very... It wasn't a fascinating game. It wasn't a brilliant game, but they just did the job, Arsenal. And that's what title winners, question mark, do.
Yeah, absolutely. It's what used to be called a workmanlike performance, didn't it? With a touch of class, you know, at the end of two very, very well-constructed goals, to be totally honest. But for me...
What if you were to lie about them, Troy?
For me, I have to go... to the penalty decision that, you know, decides that the early part of the game or the lack of a penalty decision. I still don't know what happened and how they came to that decision. Apparently, you know, they're looking at the offside. I don't know, but I don't know how it cannot be given at a penalty if you've got multiple views of that incident. I just really, really don't know. And I think that sets the tone because if Wolves do get a pen and do score the pen and was it Saliba or Gabriel? Someone gets sent off.
Saliba it was, yeah.
And he gets sent off, then it's a totally different game that we're looking at. But I suppose we could say that about a few games this season. And in the end, Arsenal, you know, got on top, particularly second half. It was a bit of a mundane game, but ultimately they did what they had to do. And, you know, in the long run, I don't think they care. They've gone 5 points clear. And you know, they go to this break with great options of what they do come Boxing Day.
I confess, John, when they were discussing the penalty decision at length, my mind wandered and I just thought, well, it wasn't given, so I'm just going to move on with the football match. But maybe, you know, so is Troy spot on? Is that was definitely a penalty?
I've got to confess, a similar wandering of mine, but I didn't think it was quite as cast iron as Troy did. I mean, it seemed like a bit of a coming together, that type of thing.
Wilson, the deciding vote?
Well, I think it was a foul. I don't think it would be a red card because I think you could say he was close enough to make a tackle. But I also think it was offside, wasn't it?
That's what I
thought.
No, it wasn't.
Was it given offside in the end?
No, because they didn't go back to look at the offside because they decided it wasn't a foul. So I think they were wrong to say it wasn't a foul. But I mean, look, I was pausing on the TV... which I accept is not as accurate as other ways of checking these things, but it looked offside to me.
I think that's just what VAR do anyway. They just press pause, and if they're just a bit forward or back, they just go, "Oh, that's fine. Don't give it."
What, you mean that isn't what they do?
They've got a VHS. They've got a VHS, and they just press stop, and then the footage goes on for a little bit, and then it just freezes and just sort of jiggles along for a bit, and then
just somebody with very, very quick reactions to press pause as soon as it passes.
And then
play.
Occasionally, occasionally your dad's videoed a Western over the last 20 minutes of the game, and say, you've no idea VAR wasn't working. Sorry, Troy.
Listen, it was dinner time for me, so maybe I wasn't focusing on the chat, but I thought they said it was offside. It wasn't offside, sorry, but I may have been focusing on what was in front of me rather than what they were
talking about. I think they said they didn't check it because they didn't think it was an obvious error.
Can I ask you a football question, Wilson? Look, how similar are Arteta's Arsenal to a Pep team? Like, we'll talk about Pep letting Zinchenko and Jesus go in a second, but in terms of what Arteta has Arsenal doing, and obviously he learned a lot under Pep, is he just sort of cut and paste that, or is it markedly different or subtly different?
I mean, you can see the lines of influence, I think, quite clearly. But I think this is, I think this is interesting in regard to Xavi. So my suspicion increasing to Xavi is that, yeah, he played for Pep. He heard all the words being said by Pep. He took them in and he can spout them out again. And I'm not entirely certain he's fully understood what Pep's philosophy is. I think his is trying to be a carbon copy. I don't get a sense that he is adapting it for his circumstances. And nothing he says in post-match interviews only leads me to think there's any great understanding there beyond being able to say the words that Pep used to say to him. Whereas Arteta clearly has assimilated the ideas and is using them in his own way. So I think you'd say it's a bit different now with Haaland, because that's obviously changed how City play. But that front three is a lot more direct, I think, than certainly than Guardiola's City has ever been. I think the use of Odegaard, I don't think there's anybody who's quite, in a Pep side, has ever been quite so central to creating. But, I don't think Guardiola's really used number 10 in the same way. But, the shape is the same, the basic principles are the same. You can see that we are where the influence is. But I think Arteta has learned lessons and is applying them in the right way, which suggests he has actually learned them rather than just parroting them, as I fear Xavi may be doing.
Joel says, is Pep finally guilty of underthinking something? Is selling Jesus and Zinchenko to Arsenal for affordable prices and seemingly accelerating the process of catching City starting to look like a mistake? Troy?
I was surprised, like I say, particularly to rivals, and you strengthen a team that needed strengthening in those areas. They needed a number nine or someone that could play up there, but also someone that was smarter and cleverer with other good players around him. And Jesus has proved that. And I know he's on a little bit of a goal scoring drought, but his contributions cannot be denied. The creativity for Vieira, to then chip that one across the box. And just his all-round general play. So I remember Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank in one of the earlier games in the season, like criticising him. You need to be in the box. You need to be in the box. You need to be in the box. But if he can do what he's continuing to do and be as creative a player as a goal scorer, then I don't really see the problem there. And Arsenal have benefited from that. Shevchenko has come in at a time when Tierney has had fitness problems. And so, again, has meant that they haven't had to rely on bringing him back or playing a right back over at left back. And the Shevchenko has come in and has proved to be as good as what we knew, but his consistency levels are above. So you have to say that Pep has generally helped them. They're 5 points clear. I'm sure Pep will somewhere be going, maybe I shouldn't have sold both, but he will back his team to win the title at the end of the season. But that will be, we'll have to wait and see on that one.
Liverpool 3, Southampton 1. Klopp wasn't in the dugout, which I think is good that he got a game ban. And he afterwards said, look, I apologised. I deserved it. It's done. Liverpool are 7 points off the top four with a game in hand. This game is about Darwin Nunes, really. Two really good finishes, especially the first one. It was a very sort of controlled and measured finish. Wasn't the chaos, John, that we expect from Nunes, that touch?
No. Have we ever doubted that Nunes would score goals? I'm not sure we ever did, really. I think it was more his effect on the rest of the team around him that's been the issue, in that chaotic element. Doesn't fit into, certainly since Thiago's been at Liverpool, it's quite a rather slicker style of play than you might associate with Klopp from earlier in his career. But you have to say that without Darwin Nunes, Liverpool will be in deeper trouble. He's done okay. And we started the season on this sort of sliding scale of Nunes versus Haaland. For the Community Shield, it was, Liverpool have won this one, and then for weeks on end, Haaland looked like the greatest player of all time. And then he's suddenly gone off the boil by not scoring for what is it, 2 games now or something like that? Or
from open play,
might
three.
Be 3. Good. Oh dear. Well, it's over for him, yeah. And now Nunes is the greatest player ever, and these are the times we live in. And again, has the World Cup break come? Yes, he is going to the World Cup, isn't he? I think Jurgen Klopp would probably appreciate a bit more time to work with Darwin Nunes. He may be hoping, though, giving his best wishes to his player that Uruguay perhaps don't go that far and he gets a bit more time to get Nunes to do stuff like bend his runs and all that type of stuff that strikers have to do.
That was the closest sort of Keys and Gray moment of bending runs of this nonsense in my day. You just ran in a straight line. What's this ridiculous idea?
Bending runs is a bit of a sort of 2000s concept, isn't it? It was Jibril Cissé, wasn't it, that was accused that when he joined Liverpool, and actually it was not a dissimilar signing, you know, one of the reasons why it didn't work out was that Jibril Cissé didn't bend his runs. That was the...
You just want to play Super Cup. You know that game where the players were just attached and just went up and down? You knew where you stood then.
Yeah, have bending runs gone out of the game though? That's what I need to know.
Do a long read. Sorry, Troy?
No, I was just going to say I found the criticism rather harsh, and it all came, didn't it, from the, you know, sending off against Crystal Palace, and then people questioned his mentality and his, you know, whether he could stand up to the rough and tumble of the English game, you know. But he's got as many goals as Jesus in a shorter space of time. So straight away, you kind of think to yourself, well, he has adapted. He is putting the ball in the back of the net when Salah is not proving consistent at the moment. And ultimately, like we've said, with the goals that he scored recently, you know, he's obviously playing into the Liverpool way. And you've got to praise him for that. But also, you know, the beardless Alisson, couple of world-class saves there. You know, whether he would have made those saves with a full beard, I'm not sure, but...
I didn't recognise him. I was like, when they said great save by Alisson, I was like, oh no, the commentator's having an absolute mare here. That isn't... that's not Alisson. Someone should tell him. Surely there's a producer in the background that's like, that isn't Alisson. What are you doing? I had no idea. I had no idea who it was. I was staring at him going, who on earth is that? Anyway, you're right. He was at fault for the goal, wasn't he? But then he did make some really good saves. There's a Liverpool conspiracy theory in the rounds that Mo Salah doesn't get any penalties. Robin says, don't mention this situation at all. 3! Oh, wait, of course you won't. What must happen for Salah to get a penalty? He might have been pulled down. Had it been given, it wouldn't have been overturned. But, you know, I haven't been studying every minute of footage of Mo Salah being fouled in the box, so my apologies. Marley says, why do pundits always refer to Alexander-Arnold as Trent? I don't mean to come across as paranoid. I'm starting to think it's specifically and deliberately to annoy me. Yeah, I think early on in my pod reign, I got really yelled at for calling John Terry JT, as if he was like a really close friend. I sat next to him once at a charity dinner. But I spent more time talking to Mrs. Terry about Death in Paradise, you'll be pleased to know. And we were both big fans and we bonded on that. And John was just trying to get into the conversation, but we wouldn't let him. But he was talking to other people, clearly. Let's go to Fulham. Fulham 1, Manchester United 2. Graham says, is Garnacho versus Almiron going to be the next Ronaldo v Messi? Damien, will any Mancunian eatery be adding garnachos to their menu? How will they prepare said dish? For what it's worth, I think it'll be a nacho-based version of chips and gravy. You were there, Wilson. How was it?
It was a really enjoyable game. I had a lovely time. I thought Fulham were the better side for most of the game. Certainly all the second half until Garnacho came on, Fulham had all the threat. I think United really missed Diego Dalot, suspended. Willian and Robinson down the left caused all kinds of problems for Fulham. So yeah, I mean, it's twice in successive weeks that Fulham have conceded late goals to drop points against Manchester clubs. Marco Silva's clearly pretty annoyed about that, but they played well in both. Well, particularly today, I thought they played really well and very unfortunate. But United got the win and... they're now, 3 points off fourth, having played a game more.
Would you say, John, things are looking up for Manchester United? Where are they looking? Up, sideways? Certainly not down.
I mean, if you go after the Brighton and Brentford game, it looks, you know, all doomed. And, the cliche these days, isn't it, is trust the process. And so far, Ten Hag has not done anything to mean that anyone's going to distrust him with that process, because I mean, actually, Garnacho, the match winner, interesting the way that he's been introduced. Obviously, he scored those goals in the League Cup, but he's introduced while receiving a bollocking, which I think is an interesting way to... Which is Ten Hag saying, and also it was Bruno Fernandes, wasn't it, saying his attitude stinks, but he's really good, which appears to be...
He's like Barry, isn't he?
But there is no doubt in his talent. The rivalry that I was thinking of is that obviously Manchester City have Julian Alvarez, who I think is 3 years older, actually, but, you know, maybe that's the, you know, the... Which, who's got the better Argentinian in Manchester? That might be the thing. But I mean, he's an exciting young talent. And beyond that, actually, I did think United, until he came on, looked a bit old, if I may say. Eriksen obviously scored. Casemiro, again, both of those players are possibly looking a bit towards Qatar and, you know, how much leg room they're going to get on the flight or something like that, and perhaps a little distracted. And actually, like Jonathan, I would say Fulham were the better team. And I've seen Fulham quite a bit this season, and they seem to be the better team in just about every game I've seen them, and perhaps aren't getting the results. And I suppose the obvious thing to say is that if Mitrovic had been there, there's a couple of balls that fizzed across the box that you thought, if Mitro was around, those are going in. And one player I should mention, I thought was very good in the game, and is a player that I think quite a lot of people thought his time was over, is Willian. Has been excellent this season for Fulham.
Yeah. I also thought for the goal, I thought it could quite work out how Garnacho got there. Like, it just felt like there were like four Fulham players who were definitely going to get that ball. But yeah, he's quick. Isn't he? That helps. Andy says, with 5 weeks of preparation, who is best placed for the next round of the Carabao Cup games? United front three of Sancho, McTominay and Garnacho should be too much for Burnley? Question mark. Thank you, Andy. Bruno Fernandes, speaking to Sky Sports after the game about the World Cup, said it should be done in a better way. We know the surroundings of the World Cup, what has been in the past few weeks, few months, about the people that have died on the construction of the stadiums. We are not happy about that at all. So it's actually quite strong to hear a player come out and say that. So we applaud you. Many times I've been annoyed by Bruno Fernandes moaning at someone or falling over into players or just generally being quite annoying as a footballer, but I applaud you for saying those things. And that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll do the rest of the Premier League and any other business. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Bournemouth 3, Everton 0. Is Wilson, you know, to lose once, to get hammered once away at Bournemouth in a week is, you know, could be unlucky. To do it twice is, what, carelessness, would you suggest?
I think it's a sign of not being particularly good at the moment. You know, everybody got very excited because Everton had those six games in a row where they didn't concede huge numbers of goals. And, oh, yeah, Frank sorted out the defence. Well, no, he'd signed two really good centre-backs who chucked themselves in the way of everything and not played any particularly good teams in that run, which makes it easier to concede fewer goals. So I think all those issues we've highlighted throughout Lampard's managerial career about the inability to structure a defence, none of them have gone away. Having said that, I think on Saturday, a lot of the problems were individual errors. That I think Pickford was, well, certainly at fault for the first one, I think a little bit at fault for the second, although he did have the issue of Tarkowski lying semi-conscious in the middle of the box, which I think the game should have been stopped for that. But, you know, that's a little bit of a red herring. I think the game should have been stopped, but Bournemouth absolutely battered them. So
Connor Cody said, we need to take a long, hard look in the mirror as players. Troy, does that include injured players as well, or do they don't have to take a long, hard look in the mirror?
I think the injured players get a little bit of a pass, particularly those that haven't stepped foot on the field of play this season at all. Listen, I'm hearing that story far too many times. And that shows an issue that is far greater than even what we visibly see on the field of play. Because Jonathan's right, they were absolutely battered in the same way they were absolutely battered in midweek. You know, there's two games left before you have a long break. One, I don't know why a weakened team was put out against Bournemouth in the first game, almost as if the cup doesn't matter. So a cup run doesn't matter to Everton. And that gives Bournemouth the upper hand. You know, they didn't win 1-0, 2-1. They beat them 4-1. And that must give them the upper hand, knowing that 4 days later, they're going to play them again. And Everton didn't get out of gear at all. And it's, for me, massively worrying signs yes, they have signed two really good defenders, but again, that only lasts for so long. And all of a sudden, there's the similar traits that happened for a lot of for the reason why Frank was put in charge and hasn't stopped that rot, is creeping into play. Listen, I think everyone saw the scenes at the end of the game. Those fans who I always come on this pod and say how incredible they can be, have started to turn. They've started to turn again in the same way that they turned against Rafa Benitez's Everton. And when it gets that way, there's not a lot. I think that this break, this is one manager where the break has come at just the right time. And he needs to think about what he does by the time they come back in on Boxing Day.
Brian says, are Everton unmanageable? To which Patrick replied, that's the best question I've ever seen for a football podcast. Is it the impossible job?
Not the best question he's ever seen. Well, he hasn't listened to many pods then, has he? listen, there are obviously problems behind the scenes at the football club that still haven't been addressed. And it's almost like, you know, they've got Frank in to stop the kind of all the hate that was leveled at the board. And Frank has taken some of that pressure away because the fans found him likable. Although his record is very similar, I understand, to Rafa Benitez's record. But at some stage, that board is, no matter what they're doing with the new ground and what everything else, they want them out and they want new owners in. And until they get new owners in and people potentially, we can't say this, that care about the football club, I think that they're just going to have they fall from bottom. They're going to have a similar season to last year. And everyone said, you know, at the end of last season, we never want to be in this position again. Well, you're in exactly the same position as what you were last year.
Well, I think it's worse. I think it's, or maybe not worse than the end of last season, but worse than this time last year.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they had the Usmanov money then, and they don't have that now. And that is leaving a black hole that I'm not sure how it's going to be filled.
Good shout.
And Sullivan Rondon is a year older as well. Yeah. So, you know, that.
I mean, I'm not sure if the decline's come in the past 12 months, in fairness.
look, Gary O'Neill did his lap of honour. Look, Bournemouth were brilliant in this game. That really deserved their win. Is it harsh that he doesn't get the job, John, if he doesn't get it, which we think he won't? Is it harsh but possibly right, or should he definitely get it?
When the talk is Bielsa, which I still have my doubts if that will come off, I must say. It was a few years ago now, but it was a real surprise that he did go to Leeds and in the first place. So I think when you think of like caretakers doing a good job, I always cast back to Tony Parks, Blackburn legend, who did that job many times and was really good as a caretaker. And then there was one season where it felt like they'd actually given him the job full time and it didn't go very well. And I think that's when they got him Graham Souness. But I don't know. Jonathan, remember Malcolm Crosby? Wasn't he
I'll never forget Malcolm Crosby.
Malcolm Crosby was a caretaker manager and did a good job. And then as soon as he got the job, it did.
Well, they gave him the job full time between the semi final and final of the FA Cup, and it was the worst thing they could have done.
Yes, exactly. So those are the examples. And, you know, listen, Gary O'Neill is not the same as Malcolm Crosby or Tony Parks, but it's a different era. But I saw Bournemouth the other week, and he seems to almost seem like he could be a Premier League manager because he's good at moaning about the referee and in the style of the old stages. But I think he's been quite evasive on the question of he clearly wants the job, but I suspect is quite defeatist about the prospect of getting it. So he was asked, wasn't he, you know, well, what about that? You think you could get the job? And it's like, you know, I just want to thank the players and all that. It was almost as if he was accepting of it. It seems unfair, but it's possibly the right decision. And actually, it's probable that whoever takes the job, Bournemouth go down and Gary O'Neill comes out looking okay, whatever happens. So
West Ham 0, Leicester 2. Leicester's first seven games, worst defence in Premier League history after seven games, says Steve. Next eight games, six clean sheets, three goals conceded. Some turnaround, isn't it? They, John, are good again.
They are. And Brendan Rodgers, he was subject to those wild rumours you might receive on a Monday morning. Rodgers gone, that type of message that you receive. And he didn't go. And there was some talk that he might want to go, but he hasn't gone, and he's actually done a very good job, because underneath it all, Brendan Rodgers is quite a decent manager. Now, is Brendan Rodgers known as a supreme organiser of the defence? Well, no, you can't really say that, can you? But what he has done, I'm not sure if all the credit should head in this direction, but Wout Fijs, who obviously was missing at the start of the season, appears to have been a revelation. So I suppose that's one of those things where if you aren't a great organiser of a defence, get a player in your team who might be able to organise it for you. And that appears to be what's gone on. All credit to them, to Leicester. Good to see James Maddison scoring. A bit of a worry to see him pulling up with an injury. But all seems to be okay there. That did look like that. There's always one player, isn't there, before the Premier League. I remember Kieran Dyer was the final Premier League weekend, just in tears before one World Cup. And it didn't seem to happen this weekend, so I was glad about that. And then, I'm sure you might want to push this on, but David Moyes is another manager who has his training camp come at the right time, or has it not? I don't know.
Yeah, as he says, when do West Ham bite the bullet and say, thanks for the Europa League memories, David, but it's time to go. The Conference League has papered over too many cracks. Any mid-table Premier League club could do well in it. How much time would you give him? Wilson, how much time would you give David Moyes?
Well, I wouldn't have appointed him, but now that he's in the job, he's done far better than I thought he was going to do. And West Ham have never finished in the top seven three seasons in a row. So, yeah, had they repeated last season's performance this season, it would have been the greatest one of the three successive seasons in the club's history. I think to be talking about him leaving the job now is astonishingly harsh. Load of players came in the summer. I think there's legitimate questions as to whether the sort of players that Moyes will get the best out of, but I think he at least deserves the time, the chance to try and put them together. And again, West Ham puzzle me, because every time I watch them, when they're at home, they get handed a load of goals that shouldn't count. When they're away, they always play really well and don't win. So I feel that their results have got absolutely nothing to do with their performances. They're completely dislocated at the moment. And that's another reason I think nobody should sort of jump to conclusions about them.
Look, I want to talk about the England squad, and I want to talk about that, Qatar. So unless you have hugely interesting things to say about Brighton Villa or Forest.
Should have been a penalty, Max. Villa should have had a penalty, or Brighton should have had a penalty, sorry.
I agree with Troy on that one, yes.
There you go. And Will Sahar missed his third pen in four out of the last four. So that's a good stat, that is. Why is he still on pen?
That is a good stat. So look, well done Unai Emery, and my apologies especially to Villa and Forest fans who'd want more, but look, the England squad is out. You all know what it is now. We didn't think Maddison was in. He is in. Wilson, do you think I really enjoyed the sort of rage circle of people being furious that he wasn't going to be picked, and then furious that he was picked because he was only picked because Gareth Southgate thought that people wanted him to be picked, and now are furious that he's not going to start. I enjoyed that rage circle, but given that Chilwell and James are injured, it kind of opened the door for Southgate to make actually not that many difficult choices, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, we've already talked a bit about Ivan Toney. I think he's the one who's really unlucky to miss out. But at the same time, it's a straight choice between him and Callum Wilson. Is Callum Wilson stealing a place in the squad? Well, clearly not. He's clearly also a really good player in pretty good form at the moment. So, I think you could argue that one either way. I guess Ivan Toney's unlucky that Callum Wilson's hit one of his rare spells of being fit for 6 weeks in a row to miss out. Maddison, Southgate will not have picked somebody because of public pressure. Southgate is very much his own man. He said after those terrible Nations League performances in June that he'd begun to compromise, and those results and those performances had been a wake-up call to him that he had to go back to his principles. So I think particularly now, he wasn't going to let himself be browbeaten. I think he's picked Maddison because Madison's in great form. And Maddison is a player who, if you need to break up a game with 20 minutes to go, he can do something. In the same way that Grealish, I think, is unlikely to start games at the World Cup. But he can come off the bench, run against tired defenders and create things, win free kicks, win penalties. So I think Maddison inclusion makes sense, but I think it would also be pretty surprising if he starts, because the people he's up against are Phil Foden and Mason Mount, and they're both really, really, really good footballers.
Well, what do you make of the squad, John? Are you happy? Are England going to win the World Cup? Do you? How excited / not excited are you about this whole competition?
Am I excited about this whole competition? No, because it's just weird, isn't it? That's the whole issue of it. Yeah, I mean, listen, if you work in this industry like we all do, I've had to involve myself in a couple of previews and looking ahead to it. But it's still, because there isn't that build-up, we go straight to a week, there hasn't been that sense of anticipation. It's just sort of arrived, but it's always been on the horizon. Well, not considering what would happen, and here we are. And thinking about the England squad, I was thinking about who are the players that will not play. That was one of the issues I had. And Connor Cody would be one, though I do think he's a good player. And you're into this good tourist thing that I mentioned before. Connor Gallagher as well. Maybe it's all the Connors. And the 26-man squad's big, and I know there's more substitutions these days, but that's a lot of hanging around to do. It depends how long England are there.
And it is £15 a pint of Budweiser, so I don't know if Colin Gallagher's going to be up for that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, he doesn't. Yeah, and you know, I mean, Jonathan will be there this time next week. Is that right?
Yeah, I go on Thursday. I tell you, I'm not. Yeah, I wouldn't pay a fiver for a pint of Budweiser. It's only paying 15 quid.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Qatar v Ecuador, I know they changed the date of it. It's been on our horizons for so long. It's the one we've all been waiting for.
Look, we've recorded some specials and they'll go out this week along with our previews, talking about the off-the-pitch stuff as well. Speaking of which, Henry says, what are the panel going to shred in solidarity with Joe Lycett versus Qatar and David Beckham? He said he'll put £10,000 of his own money into a shredder in a week's time if David Beckham doesn't end his multi-million pound deal with Qatar to promote the World Cup. He said he'd donate the money to charity if Beckham agreed to cut ties with the World Cup host. But if not, the footballer's status as a gay icon will be shredded along with the cash in a live stream next Sunday before the opening ceremony. Look, we talked about sort of Beckham's hypocrisy on the last pod. I think what's fascinating, Troy, is how few people within the game have called out his hypocrisy. You know, he was the front page of Attitude magazine. He's talked a lot about being an ally with the LGBTQ plus community. And that just cannot fit with being an ambassador for Qatar.
Max, money talks. Let's be realistic. You know, at the be all and end all.
But how much money do you need? Like fine. Like somebody offered you £150 million, I would kind of understand. I think it'd be a bit of a weird choice given your
yeah,
job
I understand
title.
That. But money breeds money. And when you have money, you just want more and more money. And values and principles go out the window. And unfortunately, I think with this World Cup, there's a lot of values and principles that have gone out the window, from the silence of the nations that were trying to qualify, from, you know, the very low-key conversations in this space by very prominent figures, by people taking money. And also, and I know you praised Bruno Fernandes earlier, but for me, isn't that a little too late? Isn't that what we should have been hearing all the way along in this conversation? Because everyone knows, you know, the human rights issues that are surrounded by this World Cup, and the reason why they were awarded the World Cup. So I haven't been invested in it so far. I'm not saying that I won't watch a game or whatever, but it just doesn't feel right to me, and it hasn't felt right for a very long time. And I get it, the focus around David Beckham. Gary Neville's been called out quite a bit. I get it. I understand it. But these guys, money just creates money for these guys, and ultimately they're choosing what they do, and they're throwing everything else that they've aligned themselves to out the window. And it's one of those things, and they're not the only ones. And it's something that, you know, the World Cup will pass, we'll get a winner, we'll glorify in the winner, we'll start our seasons back again, and everything will be forgotten again. So for me, the whole scenario of this World Cup has been embarrassing for football far and beyond, to be totally honest.
No, like, I don't disagree with anything you said. I guess on Bruno Fernandes, I guess you know it depends what your expectations of people are, and
Max, and I'm not criticizing you. No,
No, I know. I didn't think you were. I was talking about Bruno Fernandes, about like what our expectations of footballers are. And like when Klopp sort of said, oh, you know, like, it shouldn't be up to footballers. They're not human rights activists. And I kind of agree with that. But they are still like humans who live in the world, right? They can be made aware of these things. But, you know, if you compare, you know, Eddie Howe sort of said, look, I'm a football man. I can only talk about football. It's a slightly different scenario, right? Because he doesn't want to talk about his bosses, and Fernandes has distance between what he's saying and, you know, the World Cup.
But the footballers carry the most weight in this space, Max. Regardless of whatever we think, the player, whether people think that they should be talking about human rights or politics or whatever it may be, they have the most powerful voice in this space, bar none. So I would have expected players to have spoken up long before this time, but ultimately they have their own kind of situation to protect. They'll speak when they want to speak. And they'll only speak when they want to speak. They won't be pushed into a situation. So, you know, we're a week away. Bruno's spoken. Happy days. But for me, it's just too late.
Yeah, and I totally agree with what Troy said. And I think within that silence from journalists, for some journalists, not every journalist, of course, from certain broadcasters, like Gary Neville, who's gone to work for the Qatari broadcaster, like David Beckham, but beyond those people that are actually putting themselves out front, the silence of people, you are letting the Qatar World Cup go ahead unnoticed, and this idea of, well, is the man in the street really bothered about this, and able to, your silence allows this to go ahead.
Well, hopefully we will get the balance right throughout the tournament. Howard says, why are we talking about this last weekend when most of us are just carrying on with our teams playing football? It's a very good point, isn't it? The League One, League Two just carrying on. The Championship comes back on December the 10th. Must be weird for those players, right? If you're a professional footballer, you've never had a game. Like, you know, if you play for Accrington and there's a World Cup game, you're like, well, I mean, maybe it won't have, obviously you go to work, people go to work and watch the World Cup, but it just might be slightly odd for the players to be part of that.
I suppose it's gone on in club rugby and cricket or whatever for years. Point. There's always World Cups ticking over, so why should football be different?
I don't know if you've read Simon Haddonstone's brilliant piece about 1990, the semi-final. He's tried to catch up with all the England semi-finalists from 1990. He speaks to Lineker and Paul Parker and Peter Shilton and Terry Butcher and Mark Wright, amongst others. But he also talks about the journey of trying to get in touch with everybody. And his conversation with David Platt, I thought, was fascinating, where David Platt just replied to a text going, I'm afraid I don't do media anymore. And Simon texted him back and said, his reply is fuller and more interesting than I expect. This is what David Platt said. He said, I've reached a point in my life where I'm fortunate to be able to live as I choose within reason. I have a couple of business interests that keep me occupied, play my golf, walk the dog, watch my boy play sport. There's no need to retain my profile because I'm happy living how I am. I don't need to be in the public eye. I don't need to be recognised. It's exciting searching for anonymity. So obviously the question on the back is, have you seen David Platt? Can we find David Platt? But that's not what David Platt wants. But I just, it was quite refreshing to hear somebody say, you know, that was a part of my life. This is a different part of my life. So good luck. Good luck to you, David Platt. In fact, on one text topic we did on the radio going, has a footballer ever done you a favour or done like a service for you? Some bloke texted in and said, I ran out of petrol and I was trying to push my car up a hill and a man got out of theirs and started pushing up the hill and I was pushing with him and I looked to my left and it was David Platt. That'd be quite a surprise, wouldn't it? Anyway, that'll do for today. Mark says, no, Barry, is he over in LA with Susanna? No, do not. We don't need to push this rumour anymore. Barry is not going out with the Bengals. All right, and that'll do for today. Thank you, Troy.
Absolute pleasure, Max, as always.
Thank you, John.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Cheers, thank you.
Football Weekly was produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Christian Bennett. Our World Cup countdown will begin on Tuesday.
This is The Guardian. We'll be right back.